I need somebody help, not just anybody help. You know I need someone help.
Good morning, Santa Fe. Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Help by the Beatles in the background, and here at the table with me, Billy Blair, president of the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Welcome.
Good morning. What a great way to start the morning, listening to John Lennon and Help.
I know.
And I think we're going to be talking a lot about people coming together in the community to help KSFR this week and in the weeks to come.
Indeed we are. Was that too subtle?
It wasn't too subtle at all, because, you know, community radio is so important. I drive to work every morning listening to KSFR, and I bet there are a lot of other people out there like me today, whether they are John Lennon baby boomers or pre-boomers or whatever, who are part of our community, and we're hoping that they're going to pick up their phones and make a gift to KSFR by calling 428-1393.
428-1393 is the number. Now, we're going to be talking, believe it or not, to the biographer of John Lennon in just a couple of minutes. And this is an amazing biography. It is so well written. It's very interesting. Even for those of you who are Beatle fans, there's all sorts of stuff that I know that even if you've read all these books, you have not heard about. It's so cool to read this rather large book with lots of pictures. And that can be yours if you make a contribution to KSFR at 428-1393. We're also giving away the John Lennon CD, which is, I think it's called the best, I have to check the exact name of it, but I think it's called the best of John Lennon. It has really everything. It has everything he did that was good after the Beatles. And so both of those, and that actually for a low contribution, can be yours. The point is, whether or not we give you gifts like the John Lennon CD and book and so on, the point is to contribute to public radio is really, really important. It is not optional. It is not trivial. It is not a throwaway. It's an actually important, essential part of so many people's lives, and it's very important to keep it going.
Well, you know, some people think about public radio as if it's a utility, and of course it's just going to be there, like the electricity and the gas. But you know what? We pay bills for the electricity and gas, and so I just think it behooves us at this time of year to think about sending something to KSFR, and you can do that by calling 428-1393, or what I really like is to go online, ksfr.org, because when I'm driving to work and I'm trying to remember that phone number and saying it over and over and over like a mantra, and I get to work and I can't remember it, I just go on the website. And actually, I've already given something, and so I'll be talking to you. How much more do I have to give to get that CD? Because I would love to have it.
Well, we've got a couple of thank yous already. Two people have called. Report from the control room.
Yes, indeed. Kevin Mertes.
Thank you.
And Dr. Sharon Orbach.
Oh, thank you both so much. Okay, let's keep the phones ringing in a tribute to the Beatles, in a tribute to John Lennon. We're going to speak now to Philip Norman, and we'll be back with Billy Blair in just a couple of minutes. I'm happy now to welcome Philip Norman. He is the author of the new book, John Lennon, The Life. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you've written an epic and highly readable biography of John Lennon. What was your own relationship to the Beatles, and in particular to John Lennon, when they were together and afterwards?
Well, my life sort of intersected a couple of times. They were the Beatles, and I was just a young journalist. I did interview them on what turned out to be their last UK tour in 1965. I was thrown out of their dressing room by their roadie, Neil Aspinall, for outstaying my welcome. And then in 1969, I was covering the Apple organization and what was happening there, which was the Beatles were breaking up. I spent the morning in John and Yoko's office watching them talk to other people on their peace campaign.
And so when you write a book like this, obviously there's been so much written about the Beatles. I would think that there's some myths that you have to either verify or dispel when you're doing a book like this.
There were some very important ones, yes, some quite large, some smaller, which I think I did do. I mean, I had to tackle them all. I also had to look again at every single song that John had written or that John had been involved in with the Beatles, because I wanted to make this whole study of John seem new, not just new information, but new interpretation.
Philip Norman, what were some of those myths that you had to address?
The one, I suppose, the most persistent one is that Yoko Ono broke up the Beatles by taking John away. That wasn't true. John wanted out of the Beatles. He was tired of being a smiley mop top. He had so many other aspects of his creative talent that he wanted to explore. Yoko happened to come along and give him a ticket out of the Beatles, but Yoko did not break up the Beatles. In fact, John originally thought he was putting Yoko into the Beatles. He thought it was the Beatles and Yoko. There's another long-standing sort of myth about the Hamburg era, when the Beatles were just ending the time they used to play in the Reeperbahn district of Hamburg, the red light district. The myth is that John attacked his friend Stuart Sutcliffe, who had been in the Beatles, he was the fifth Beatle, and attacked him so violently it may have caused the brain hemorrhage that killed Stuart. Well, the only witness to that was Paul McCartney, the only alleged witness, and McCartney had no memory of it. But I had to sort of ask McCartney very specifically, and he said he had no memory of it.
I was fascinated by your vivid descriptions of John Lennon's early life. He was both a rebel and a well-brought-up suburban boy, albeit from a rather tumultuous family. What did you learn about that period through doing this work that was new or surprising to you?
Well, John is a mass of contradictions, and on one level, his upbringing was a very nice upbringing, very secure. His aunt Mimi brought him up, gave him everything that he could want, educated him very well. He wanted for nothing materially, but he grew up feeling a tremendous sense of sort of having been abandoned by first his father and then his mother. And this was something that stayed with John really for the rest of his life and obsessed him, and particularly his mother, who really gave him away to Aunt Mimi to bring up, but stayed sort of close to John. But then was killed by a motorist in an accident when John was in his teens. And John just never got over his mother Julia's death and never stopped obsessing about her right until the very last months of his life.
Let's go back to the Hamburg years. I guess it wasn't a terribly long time that they played in Hamburg, but it was their first long extended gig. How do we know what we know about that period? Are there recordings? What kind of documentation did you work with?
They did. Yes, they made some recordings. A record was even released with them as a backing group to a singer called Tony Sheridan, which much later became, you know, a great collector's rarity. They were there quite a long time. This was the red light district called the Reeperbahn, which was a kind of segregated area where sexual freedom operated so that it would not be a disturbance to the rest of the city, where all the sort of ship's crews used to go. In some ways, it was a bit like Liverpool. And they were there for a long time, having to play all night a lot of the time, and very punishingly long performance sets. Which really sort of made them as a band. I mean, they had to develop tremendous stamina. They needed lots and lots of material, which in the end became material they had written for themselves as well as cover versions.
Do you have a sense, can you give our listeners a sense of what those performances were like?
They were really like punk rock. I mean, ahead of its time. The Beatles were very sort of family friendly after Brian Epstein took them over and cleaned them up. But in those days, I mean, John in particular would behave in a sort of demented way on stage, a bit like Johnny Rotten with the Sex Pistols a few years later. He would attack people in the audience. He would spit. He would come on wearing bizarre clothes. He would sometimes be drunk. Because these were very wild times. And if you're very young, as they were, you don't feel mortal. You feel immortal. You don't feel these habits will have long-term effects on you. So John especially was, you know, very, very wild in the Hamburg era.
When did he and Paul McCartney really start writing songs together?
They started pretty soon after they met. They were, as a partnership, very unusual because songwriting partners, as a rule, do not each write both the words and the music. So initially they would both contribute to the words and music of a song. Later on, they would write separately, but they would still turn to one another for help in finishing the song. They could also switch personalities. John, we associate with rather hard, rocking kind of music. But actually, John loved ballads and was very sentimental and romantic, and he could write a song that sounded like a Paul McCartney song. And Paul could write a hard-edged John Lennon song. They could switch personalities. It was a very symbiotic relationship, and even when the Beatles were falling apart as sort of collaborators in other ways, the McCartney-Lennon, Lennon-McCartney partnership, creative partnership, was still working.
Their personalities seem so different, but they did have a lot in common, besides that they were both very gifted musicians from Liverpool. They were both punsters and had certain very similar sensibilities.
That's right. They were both sort of star English students at their schools. Lennon is always said, you know, in folklore to have been a total sort of loser at school. Actually, in some subjects like English and art, painting, he was a star pupil, and his teachers would keep his books, his exercise books, to show to other pupils as an example of what they should aim for. And yes, he was a brilliant English student, and McCartney was very, very gifted too. And in class, Lennon came from the middle class but wanted to be a street kid. Paul was more from the working class, but he aspired upwards, so they kind of met in the middle.
So 1960 represented the beginning of Beatlemania, at least in Liverpool. What did it look like?
Well, it started off when they were playing at the Cavern Club in the very early 60s, this underground club that was virtually just a sort of hole in the ground, under an old cheese warehouse that really smelt bad and never smelt any better. They were on a little tiny stage, but it was almost like a movement even then. They had their regular adoring female fans who were only a few inches away from them. Later on, Beatlemania became something that it was like a sort of, a virus that infected the media and infected teenagers in Britain, then in Europe, then in America, then in the world. And it was just screaming, yelling, not listening to their music really, but just this kind of mass hysteria. And that was what John, in the end, began to hate, because no one was listening to his music when they played, and they couldn't hear themselves because of the screams. So John would just crash his arm down on the keyboard of his electronic organ that he came to play in the later years, in just sheer frustration.
But in the beginning, in this cavern, there were real fans, and it wasn't just young women, it wasn't just girls, it was boys and girls who really loved the music.
Yes, because they played this kind of raw R&B, young men liked it as well, and young men kind of responded to John's toughness, which was all fake, really, because he wasn't really very tough. But it was the sort of female adoration that sort of was the power. Beatlemania, and when the Beatles first got their hit single, their very first hit single in the UK, and it was announced at the Cavern Club, all the girls in the audience burst into tears, because that meant if the Beatles had got a hit nationwide, that meant the Liverpool fans had lost them.
We're talking to Philip Norman, author of the book John Lennon, The Life, which can be yours if you make a contribution to KSFR. Billy Blair, when you were talking a moment ago, you were saying how people think of KSFR as a utility. It's just always going to be there, just the way the power comes in through your socket and the cable TV comes onto your television screen and so on, that you can always just turn on the radio. Well, I was thinking, I just got out my calculator and was doing a little bit of calculation. And, some people's electric bill might be, electric and gas bill might be $100 a month or more. Some people's cable bill might be $50 a month or more. Some people's internet bill might be another 20, 10 or 20 and up per month. We are asking people to make a contribution of something like $5 to $10 a month. Very modest contribution. Everybody makes that contribution and we stay on the air. What's not to like about that? It's a bargain.
It's a bargain, and you know what, Mary Charlotte, it's not enough. I'm going to say that what people should do is when they think about making these gifts to KSFR, that they could actually call your line. They could call 428-1393, give a credit card number, ask your people to do an automatic credit card deduction every month, they could give $30 a month. And how much would they miss that? That's less than one of those bills. That's less than going out and having 10 cups of cappuccino. That's less than going to 3 movies. It's certainly less than going out to dinner. And you won't even feel it.
It'll just come
off of your credit card. And then it supports community radio, which is what makes us a great community. You know, I love listening to your show because we hear so much about our nonprofit activities all the time, you know, with Mary Charlotte's cafe show in the morning. And I'm loving this interview you're doing about the Beatles because it takes us back. But what you can do with public radio is you can take people back, but then you also take them forward because you're telling people what is happening now and what to expect and putting things in context.
4281393. I love the idea of the monthly contribution because I do that with several organizations, with media and environmental organizations. I've signed up, and there's one of them that I've been doing this for probably 15 years. And, you know, $15 a month or $20, I do a couple of different ones, comes out of my checking account. And the whole thing for the various nonprofits is $50 a month, which I'm sorry, I'm just not missing it. And you won't either, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to make a contribution of that kind, just tell the person whom you call when you call them at 4281393 that that's what you want to do. I've seen the pledge forms. It's really easy to do. And just go ahead and do it. It's also really fun because the people are so nice, and you don't have to have your name read on the air, but you can. We had another caller that called during this segment. I don't know if their name wants to be announced, so I won't announce it right now, but you can be anonymous. You can have your name read, whatever you want. Most of all, you can keep public radio on the air. We do this because we have to. And you do it because you want to listen to public radio. I hope your listeners want to listen to public radio. So give a call now to 4281393. We also have a terrific John Lennon disc. You can basically get this wonderful disc with all the John Lennon songs on it that are so fabulous. It's called Lennon Legend, The Very Best of John Lennon. And we'll just send it out in the mail to you. So 4281393 is the number. We're going to go on now with Philip Norman. You paint a realistic and sympathetic portrait of Brian Epstein, who happened onto one of their performances in the Cavern Club and then immediately became their manager. And the book gives a wonderful sense of that confluence between the Beatles' raw talent and the strong management and production of Brian Epstein and then later George Martin. 1963 was the year in which they became an international phenomenon. What happened between 60 and 63?
Well, Brian didn't really discover them until 1962. And between 60 and 62, they were going regularly out to Hamburg. They were getting a big following on Merseyside, the larger industrial area around Liverpool. But Brian, it was the end of 61, beginning of 62, that Brian first started managing them. And of course, there was no rock culture then. There were no rock groups. They were just pop beat groups, they used to be called. And the only way they were thought to be able to survive in the entertainment business was to learn to tap dance and become showbiz entertainers. And that was the route that Brian Epstein really took them on initially, because that had worked for the other famous group in Britain at the time was Cliff Richard and the Shadows. And, you know, they'd got very much into conventional showbiz and appearing in stage musicals and pantomimes and that kind of thing. And that was what Brian thought the Beatles should do initially.
And where did it go from there?
Well, then, of course, they were still among a lot of other music, rock bands, pop bands. It took a while for them to be absolutely unchallenged at the head, equaled or only rivaled in some ways by the Rolling Stones. But it was only really with the arrival in America in 1964, where no British music act had ever really conquered the American charts. There had been freakish hits by British acts over the years, some of them rather unlikely ones. But for the Beatles to absolutely make the whole country adore them and the music business start to copy them in the US was quite unprecedented.
what was happening in the U.S. and in England that culturally that made the world so ripe for the Beatles at that moment?
Well, in America, there was this sort of hegemony in popular music because the pop music came from America, and there were amazing talents. You know, there had been, and there still were. They were still coming along, like the Beach Boys, lots of early singer-songwriters like Neil Sedaka, people like that. The Brill Building era in New York, Carole King and Jerry Goffin. The Motown era was all starting to happen beginning of the 60s. And it was inconceivable, really, to America that any pop music that wasn't America could please the Americans. I think there was a sort of loss of, you know, kind of a tremendous sort of emotional trauma at the end of 63 because of the death of President Kennedy, you know, when American values perhaps were questioned in a way they hadn't been before. So the eyes of America kind of looked outward for some diversion, some little eccentric sort of novelty from Britain. You know, Britain had always sent eccentrics to America, eccentric actors or comedians. And these four with their funny haircuts arrived.
And suddenly people went nuts. And it's interesting, you compare the Beatlemania on the part of the female adoring fans to first Frank Sinatra and then Elvis Presley, which you said were decidedly sexual, and that the Beatles phenomenon wasn't so much a sexual phenomenon. What's the difference?
They were sort of treated more like dolls. You know, the people used to throw you know, panties at Presley and people like Rudy Valli before that, and Frank Sinatra. But they threw jelly beans at the Beatles. It was sort of infantile. And they threw teddy bears, that kind of thing. The Beatles were like nursery toys.
Interesting. So the tour in the U.S., I mean, people went crazy, sold out houses, just unbelievable amounts of money. This overnight success, which nobody really expected or knew what to do with, among other things, sowed the seeds of activism in John. He witnessed the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination, as you say, and then the violent racism at the peaceful demonstrations by Martin Luther King and his followers. How did the adult political John Lennon begin to emerge?
Well, he always had very strong opinions, but as a Beatle, he was under a kind of oath of silence. That, you know, the Beatles had to smile and be charming everywhere. That was the diktat of Brian Epstein, and that was what had, you know, made them the fantastically successful act that they were, because everybody loved them. They weren't controversial. They didn't upset people. John really chafed under that sort of constraint. And so as time went on, he got more and more sort of angry about having to suppress what he felt, which had a lot to do with what was going on not only in the States, but in Britain as well. And it was only really when he met Yoko in 1966 that he felt sort of brave enough to start saying what he really felt.
It's interesting that they were put in this role of having to be essentially ambassadors for Britain, especially somebody as outspoken as John, who really didn't have kind of a diplomatic bone in his body.
That's true, and yes, the first visit to America was not like a tour. It was like a trade mission from Britain, or a royal visit, or something like that. And later on, these enormous sort of, you know, coast-to-coast tours that started to happen with the Beatles were happening with American performers as well. That was really the basis of the sort of the start of the rock culture, which, you know, now we all sort of, you know, recognize as being, you know, this kind of parallel world in which these terribly rich younger people live and perform and work and play. Then it was the Beatles arrived in show business, really, and the rock culture evolved while they were, you know, feeling their way as performers.
I think it's also interesting, and going back to the early success of the Beatles, what an effect they had on Britain, on England. One of the very most respected classical music critics wrote a very insightful and very positive article about them from a musical point of view, which was one of the things that made a difference in their careers.
Yes, his name was William Mann, and he was an extremely knowledgeable classical music critic for the Times newspaper, which was absolutely the stuffiest British daily paper in those days. Still had, or maybe just had about had stopped having still small advertisements on the front page, like sort of Victorian newspapers. And William Mann analyzed their songs. Well, of course, things that William Mann identified with technical terms, John Lennon and Paul McCartney were doing instinctively. They had no idea these were diminished fifths or whatever Mann called them. But yes, to have them suddenly taken as seriously as that was just unprecedented.
So despite their insane touring schedule and the loss of control that inevitably came from their success, they managed to stay, as a group, creative and have basically harmonious relationships with each other, as you write it. The group didn't have a front man. They were sort of, I think you wrote, a kind of democratic presentation. There was no one leader. But in some ways, John was the de facto leader of the group. What was that dynamic like between John and the rest of the Beatles?
Well, John had formed the group that turned into the Beatles, the Quarrymen. Most people did recognize John as the leader in manner, if not in name. It was a sort of democracy, and George played a part, and Ringo had his part too. McCartney was obviously, a creative partner of Lennon. But people instinctively, I think, did think John was the leader. And John, again, got tired of this. John's attention span could be fatigued. And so towards the end, before the breakup, he had really ceded the leadership over to Paul McCartney.
What happened? And, in the early years, there was this harmony, and they just put these incredible records together, which people are still listening to today. What happened that started to cause strife and disharmony among the members of the group?
They lived under tremendous pressure, and they were very, very close, because only those four people understood what the pressure was like. It was horrendous pressure. And creatively speaking, it's quite extraordinary to think of this, that they never really had a row. In the studio, they got on very, very well together, and they were very, very close as individuals, and quite extraordinarily close. You can hear that in the harmonies, even on the Abbey Road album, which is really sort of the beginning of the end, or the end of the beginning of the breakup. They are so close, sort of vocally, on that album. What it was John getting sort of tired, really, of what he thought of was a created prison, and wanting something different. And firstly, the fatigue of performing live, because by that time they were writing songs that were much too complex to be reproduced on stage. And then John meeting Yoko and wanting to be with Yoko and feeling that, being with the lads was no longer enough. But really, extraordinarily, there was never even the sort of final confrontation around the boardroom table at Apple, the company Apple, wasn't sort of angry. No, sort of punches were thrown like perhaps they would be today.
We're talking to Philip Norman, author of the book John Lennon, The Life. And I'm sitting here with Billy Blair, and we are listening to Philip Norman talking about John Lennon.
Well, it's interesting to hear Philip Norman talking about Abbey Road and how that was the beginning of the end, or the beginning of the beginning. Because I've often thought that if I were stranded on a desert island, that is one of the albums that I would like to have with me.
Really?
Because it is like a symphony, and it says so much. And the other thing that I'd like to have if I were stranded on a desert island is that I'd like to have a direct link to community radio. Can I get 101.1 wherever I am, or can I only get it in this service area?
You are too sweet. No, you can get it all around the world if you have an internet connection on that desert island.
I am going to have an internet connection. And I just wanted to point something out, because we're talking to people about just reaching into their pockets and their pocketbooks and making a contribution so we can keep KSFR providing this great programming that touches us all, that makes us all a community. And sometimes people think that only the rich can give, and it only matters if you give a lot. That's not true. We'd love people to call up and give $10, to give $20, to give $35 today.
And you know that from your work.
I know that from my work.
All about fundraising.
Because 80% of the money that's given comes from people who are really middle class, are not very wealthy at all. And there's a quote that I particularly love, and it's from the founder of Habitat for Humanity. And he says, "I've tried raising money two ways, by asking for it and not asking for it. And I found that I've always gotten more when I asked. So we're asking right now people to pick up the phone and dial 428-1393 and make a gift of whatever size to keep community radio, which means so much to us, on the air.
505-428-1393. And we have some thank yous in the control room.
Yes, indeed, some very generous thank yous to Robert Thompson.
Thank you.
And Joan Baker. And Joan also wants you to know, Billy, that she has contributed, and thanking you for being on the air with Mary Charlotte today.
Thank you, Joan.
And Alexana Hope.
Thank you so much.
And Sai Husbatki.
Yay.
And Mary L. says, Mary Charlotte, you are an asset to our community. Yes, indeed.
Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you. And for those of you who think that KSFR is an asset to the community, assets have value. If they have value, then you're willing to pay for them. If you're willing to pay for them, then you're willing to take the 1 minute and 30 second action of picking up your telephone and calling 505-428-1393. It's really easy. If you haven't done it before, there's kind of a barrier in people's heads. If they've never called public radio before and said, I want to contribute, they think it's something that other people do, or they think it's hard, or they think it's weird. And once you do it, it's just really an easy thing to do. And you will be, I can guarantee you, I have a chocolate chip cookie guarantee. That is that if it turns out not to be true, namely that you will feel better after you did it, I will bake you chocolate chip cookies. That's what I've been promising to people, and I will follow through on it.
Are your chocolate chip cookies worth it?
Oh, are you kidding?
I have to say that I called last week, and it's so interesting because you call and you think you're going to get this anonymous person on the other end. I called up, and I said, I gave my name, and it was Karen. And Karen said, this is Karen Sanchez. This is Karen Sanchez, an old colleague from way back. And so it's going to be one of your neighbors, because that's the great thing about community radio.
It's a great thing about Santa Fe, too. It's a relatively small town, and so people really do know each other. People really are part of it. Everybody who writes to me, I just got a message from Mary Lynn LeBlanc, who was asking if the chocolate chip cookies have lard in them. No. They do not. They are made with pure butter.
That would be better with lard.
You think? 428-1393. Stop us talking from lard, talking about lard, and make your contribution to KSFR. No, it's just a wonderful place to be part of. And what I was going to say is everybody who writes to me, virtually everybody who writes to me and has a comment about the station, I write back. I get tons and tons of email every day. It's hard to sort through it. Billy Blair, I don't know how you do it. You are the most organized person on the planet. There's some amazing people. And I do the best I can. If I see your email, which I see most of them, I do write back. And when people have comments, I write to them, because it's a small enough town that you can do that. It's also a small enough town that you can't leave the job of supporting public radio to somebody else. It's really up to every single one of us.
It is for all of us to do, and even people who've not ever thought about doing it before who are listening right now, who can call that number, 428-1393, talk to one of your lovely people who is taking those pledges, and think about doing one of those long-time credit card pledges.
That's right. Making a contribution, it's withdrawn automatically monthly. Even $15 is a wonderful amount. Sometimes it's hard to give 50 or 100 or 200, but when you do it over the course of the year with a credit card, it really is not painful at all. I think it's sometimes difficult to be grateful for what we have. Even those of us who are struggling have so much compared to people in other parts of the world who are struggling far more than most of us ever have, in terms of having a roof over their head, having food in their mouth, having clean water coming out of the tap. Virtually all of us have all of those things, and although it doesn't feel like we have that much extra, everybody has a little bit extra, and those who know it are the ones who are able to give within their means to whatever it is that they feel strongly about. And I hope that if you're listening to public radio, you feel strongly about public radio. The phone is ringing. We are delighted to hear that the phone is ringing. We're going to go back to the interview in just a second. And don't forget, you can score a copy of that terrific John Lennon CD, Lennon Legend, that has, it's basically a big. There's a lot of songs on it. Greatest hits of John Lennon thing. It has Imagine. It has some of the ones that you know very well. Probably a few you don't know as well. But a lot of great songs. Not to mention this intense biography, which was really fun to read. It took me a long time to read that book, but I did. Yeah, I did as much of it as I possibly could, which was a lot. Anyway, we're going to go back to Philip Norman. Please keep those calls coming. Keep those volunteers busy. Flood the lines. Jam the lines. And we'll be back with you in a few minutes. 428-1393. Not only were there the changes of the kind that you're describing and John wanting to do different things and so on, but there was also this huge cultural shift that happened in the mid-60s, and the Beatles co-created that and they flowed with it. And I was thinking, you know, the John Lennon who married Cynthia Powell seems so utterly different from the one who married Yoko Ono, and that was both personal development and a real shift in the times in which they lived.
I don't think it was a different John who married Yoko, different from when he married Cynthia. I mean, he had to marry Cynthia because she was pregnant, and that was what young men really did in those days, and John did what was considered the decent thing and married Cynthia. I think he was essentially the same John when he met Yoko, but of course he was still married to Cynthia, and he still was kind of obeying convention because he didn't feel that he could go public with his interest in Yoko for a long time after he met her. It was a couple of years, as she puts it, as Yoko puts it. They were sort of circling around each other cautiously. Yoko was married as well. So I don't think it was that different to John. It was just that after he met Yoko, a lot of other sides of John could come to the surface. And, you know, he could feel free to express himself as an artist, as a writer, as well as a musician.
There were so many influences that were happening that time. They met Elvis Presley, they met Bob Dylan, they were introduced to marijuana, to LSD, forays into Eastern spirituality. Did those things affect them together as a group, or they were quite different experiences for each one of them?
Well, they did things together. That was a sign of their closeness. I mean, if one of them grew a moustache, then they all grew moustaches. Ended up on, you know, the Sergeant Pepper look. If one of them wanted to meditate, then they all meditated. And they all went off to the ashram in India together. And not all of this was detrimental. In fact, the Indian trip was very beneficial. It actually gave them some rest and recreation after these tremendously sort of hyperactive years. They essentially did do things together and experience things together. Because, as I said, that only those four had the understanding of what it was like to be a Beatle.
Tell us about the making of the White Album. It was a huge phenomenon. What was the making of that double disc set like?
Well, that was when things were not so harmonious, and John wanted Yoko around. The other Beatles were very tolerant initially of having her in the studio, but George Martin was very unhappy because he felt a lot of the material was not up to their standard. He wanted it to be a single disc album, just using the very best of all that they recorded. But, you know, they insisted it was going to be a double album. But of course now, even the things that George Martin was sort of really worried by, like Revolution Number 9, which was, you know, now is considered to be sort of masterpiece against sonic surrealism.
Why do you think the Beatles, and John Lennon in particular, still speak to people so strongly, even people who weren't born when they were together?
It's extraordinary that they do. They represented musical genius, and they represented an absolutely unbeatable cast of characters. They were the first, and the world was so different then, and the world now is full of bands and artists who can say they've played to more people than the Beatles, that they've sold more records than the Beatles. But they'll never be more loved than the Beatles. The Beatles just created this extraordinary love, and they can still do it. I mean, little children listen to Beatles albums, and they love it immediately. They love the music straight away. It has this extraordinary power to create love and affection. They are just sort of, you know, eternally lovable.
What's it like for you to listen to the music now compared to in its time?
in its time, I mean, I listened to it like anyone else. I never thought I'd be writing about them. I thought there were enough writers were on this subject already, and there was no room for me. But I do remember that every single Beatles album was a real event, and it was waited for, and it was never disappointing. The thing, it was never just about money with them, and it was never cynical. They were always trying to go one better than the last album. In that, that very, very short time they were together, relatively speaking, the body of superb work that came from them is astounding to look at now and listen to.
And I think something that probably readers, or potential readers of your book, don't know is that John Lennon was also a very gifted visual artist and wordsmith, and some of that work still survives as well.
It does. You can tell that he loved words from the lyrics he wrote for the Beatles music. And a lot of people who have genius aren't satisfied with the genius they have. They want something else. John didn't want to be called a genius as a musician. He wanted to be someone more like a sculptor or a painter. And, of course, Yoko said, well, if you want that, you must go ahead and do it. But it was never, he was never getting the adulation for what he wanted to receive it for.
We don't have time to talk about the last 10 years of his life after the Beatles' breakup and before his murder. So if people want to read more about that, they can get a copy of this long and wonderful book. But having written it, now, for you, how do you hold John Lennon in your own self, and why do you think so many people continue to really identify with him?
He was enormously human. I mean, he was very, very funny. He really did add to the sort of the gaiety in the old sense of life, what Dr. Johnson called the harmless stock of human merriment. John was funny, and he was very honest. That's a rare quality as well. All this in addition to writing superb songs. He's become a sort of secular saint in a way, which he would have found hilarious because he knew he was no saint. But he's still just vibrantly alive in our modern world. Nothing seems to change that.
Philip Norman is the author of the book John Lennon, The Life. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you so much, Billy Blair, for your generosity in getting up even earlier than you usually do to do all your work with the Santa Fe Community Foundation and coming into the Santa Fe Baking Company.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And, I'm just sitting here thinking about and remembering the words of Stuart Udall, who is the Secretary of the Interior, lives here in Santa Fe, that lion in winter. And Stuart said once, Santa Fe is the most generous community in the nation. And we see that all the time at the Santa Fe Community Foundation. We see people giving for hunger needs. We see people giving for homelessness. We see people giving to the arts, for environmental improvement. And I'd just like to remind everybody who's listening today that information is also one of those important things to support. And that's what KSFR brings us. Nobody brings us information in such a way as public radio and our local public radio station, because you are our neighbors, you're right here in town, you're part of our community, and everyone who's ever given or who's never even thought about giving to KSFR before should really call that number, 428-1393, or if you're numerically challenged as I am, go to the website, and we all know that, it's ksfr.org, and go on that Pledge Now link and make that gift to make sure that we are all still one community.
428-1393. And I think that what you're saying about information is very important because, of course, how do you know what organization you want to give to in the first place if they're about hunger or homelessness or the environment or the arts? You have to be informed in the first place, and that's what we try to do. We try to keep you informed with real information, not phony information.
You do a great job of that every morning. I listen to your shows. You've interviewed so many nonprofits. I mean, you've talked to Wild Earth Guardians, and you've talked to the Opera recently. You've talked to many groups that are nonprofits in our community. And that enables people to know who's doing what work and what they really want to support. Kind of like what the Santa Fe Community Foundation does.
Indeed.
You know, in the same way in which we inform donors, people can give directly to us, and we can make sure that that organization, the organizations that are doing the best work, are the ones that get funded. You provide that information. You are such a wonderful resource in our community, and it means so much to me personally, and I hope it means so much to everybody who's listening to us.
Thank you so much, and I know you have to go in a moment, so Billy Blair, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
My pleasure, and my pleasure to support KSFR.
Thank you. Now, 428-1393 is the number, and if you like the John Lennon interview, I told somebody I was doing a John Lennon interview, and they wrote back to me on email and said, "From beyond the grave?" I said, "No, his biographer."
You're channeling him.
Marilyn, that's more like something that you might do. 428-1393 is the number. But this question of information that Billy Blair brought up a few minutes ago, I think is a very important one. Because I think of information as nutrition, and there is a balanced diet. There is a diet very heavy in certain highly nutritional foods, but lacking in others. There is a pure junk food diet, and there is starvation. And if you make the analogy of all of these things to radio, TV, the internet, and the other kinds of information in the newspaper that people get, it's pretty clear that there's some really great sources out there that give you genuine stories. Then there's a lot of kind of phony baloney stories like overly sensationalized crime stories and things like that. Then you can go on a total information blackout and have no idea what's going on around you. And some people do that for a period of time, and there's probably something healthy about that. But basically, if you want to be a participant in your community and in your democracy, you have to be informed. And it is, ladies and gentlemen, my very deeply held goal and consciously held goal to provide a balanced diet on this show, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and I think KSFR generally does that as well.
I want to know, how much do I have to pledge to get those cookies, and how many cookies can I get?
You know, we haven't put numbers on the cookies. What I'm going to do is when the pledge drive is done, I'm going to make a massive amount of cookies and declare Cookie Day. And so anybody who's made a contribution to KSFR, really in any amount, can come to my table at the Santa Fe Baking Company at a specified time and eat cookies that I have made. So that, I'm not kidding. I put that on my Facebook, and it's true.
And no lard. Hey, no wheat.
No, somebody said vegan cookies. I'm sorry. I haven't gotten there yet in my level of consciousness with the vegan cookies, although if somebody would like to make some and bring them, I would be happy to see what they're like. Can you even make vegan chocolate chip cookies? Don't they have to have...
They sell them in the store. I've seen them in bags. And actually, to be truthful, I have tasted them, and they're not bad. Not bad indeed, you know.
428-1393, and the vicissitudes of cookie making and cookie nutrition, as well as informational nutrition, can be had. But the main thing is that everybody who's listening right now, give a call to Public Radio KSFR, 428-1393. And really, you know, I have had so many people very kindly say things to me, and it's a wonderful and very gratifying thing. I mean, a lot of people, everybody who's listening now, is doing their job, whether it is getting ready to go to work in an office, or if you work outdoors, or if you are a mother or father staying home with your children, if you are working in science, if you are working as an artist in your studio or a craftsman, or working for the city or the state, working in construction, working in the trades. We have so many wonderful people who are listening to the show, listening to this station as they do their work. And I have a very lucky lot in life, which is that probably more than a lot of people, I get thank yous. I get people saying, thanks for the work you do. I love your work. I listen to your show. You can't imagine how wonderful that makes me feel on a daily basis. That said, if you have ever said that to me, or if you have ever thought that, I would really gently, kindly, and persistently ask you to put your money where your mouth is and give a contribution in any amount at all to KSFR. If you like the show, I'm serious, just pick up the phone and give now. Or as Billy Blair said, you can go online to KSFR.org.
Yeah.
We're about to go out now.
We have some thank yous before we go out.
Yay!
We have Caitlin Frost.
Yay, Caitlin!
And would you say Anonymice?
I would say Anonymice.
Anonymice, okay.
Or Anonadogs.
Dogs.
We're going to be talking about dogs and cats later in this week, just so you know.
Yes, indeed. Okay, thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Okay, 4281393 is the number, and once again, you can still get the John Lennon disc, the John Lennon book, and any of a number of wonderful other gifts, but the main thing is that you support public radio. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can leave a message at 428-15... No, that phone's not working anymore, sorry. But you can email me at radiocafe.org. You can find me at santafe.radiocafe.org. Any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's fabulous dot foil computer services, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. John Lennon in the background. Adios. See you tomorrow. Ciao.